After dinner at a house party, a French friend was frank with essayist and novelist Diane Johnson about her opinion of Americans and our sense of history. She thought we didn't really have a sense of our own history. Was this true? A few years later, we have Johnson's response. Her new book is a memoir detailing both her upbringing in Moline, Illinois, and the trials and tribulations that brought her own ancestors to the Midwest. She has a sense of her family's history, and she says a lot of other Midwesterners do too. I'm Lisa Braltz, and today on Focus, I'll talk with Diane Johnson about her new memoir, Flyover Lives. She'll tell us about her memories of Moline in the 40s and 50s, and how she traced her family history back to the 18th century. Do you have a sense of your own history? Which stereotypes do you disagree with about the Midwest? Do you agree with any? Join our conversation, coming up on Focus, after this news. Today on the show, I'm talking with writer Diane Johnson. She's a novelist and essayist and has been a two-time finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and has been nominated three times for the National Book Award in the essay, biography, and fiction genres. Her novels include 1997's Le Divorce, 2000's Le Mariage, and 2003's L'Affaire, among many others. She's the author of a new memoir, Flyover Lives, published recently by Viking Penguin. Flyover Lives is, in part, a response to a French friend's theory that Americans have no sense of their personal histories. And the book not only offers a retelling of her childhood and adolescence in Moline, Illinois, but also the circumstances of her ancestors as they made their way from France to the Northeast and eventually to Illinois. Some questions for listeners. Do you feel like you have a sense of your personal history? Do you think Americans generally struggle with this idea? What are some of your perceptions about living in the Midwest, and do you agree or disagree with those stereotypes? Give us a call today at 1-800-222-9455 and tell us what you know about your family history, the things that you've learned. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. Diane Johnson, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So I would like to start with a house party that you were out in, or that you were at in Provence, France, visiting friends. And that story kicks off your book and really does set the stage, I think, for everything that follows. Can you talk a little bit and describe the situation at this party and what was said to you that made you think, is this even true, or should I should start digging through my family history?
Well, it was something that a French friend said. We were in the south of France, visiting in a beautiful house and idyllic situation and lovely French food and so on. And the other people there were a group of American generals who were on vacation, and they were all retired, and they were taking a trip through France to look up their roots. And so this is how a conversation. I can actually read a bit, Lisa, should I, of where the
Great.
Book begins with the subject?
Oh, yes.
Okay. The topic of historical memory came up after the excellent dinner when we'd gathered on the patio, and the American Army General Rolfe was telling about his French ancestors. His colleague, Bill Baum, was in Europe to look up his roots in Germany. The Baums and Rolfes were both retired and had the luxury of time for genealogical research. Some of my forebears were Huguenots from around La Rochelle, Rolf was saying. Some were Catholics fleeing before the Revolution, the French Revolution, I mean. Many people don't realize the extent of Catholic immigration into America, mostly into Maryland. It was this discourse, well-informed and lightly given on the subject of early immigrants to America, that had prompted our hostess, Simone's, saying that it was unusual for Americans to take an interest in history in any form. After they mention the pilgrims or the covered wagons, they fall silent. They know nothing. It's because we don't believe that ancestry matters. It's what you are yourself that counts. It's an axiom of Americanness to be self-made, said John, sturdily defensive of our supposed national classlessness and belief in possibilities. Americans seem to think we French are sort of pathetic for knowing and caring so much about our background, Simone went on. It's easier for you because French history took place on such a small stage, said John. Unfairly, I thought, since French history had bled across all Europe and even to Russia. I recognized the belligerent edge to his tone, evidently stung by the knowledge that though he had a covered wagon in his family tree, his own grandmother went to California in one in the 1880s, that's about as much as he knew. She asked John and me about our ancestors and was triumphant when we gave vague answers. Most Americans she'd met had no idea about anything before their own grandmothers, if that. Indifference to history, Simone sniffed. That's why Americans seem so naive and always invade the wrong countries. How American we suddenly felt. It's when you're in a foreign land and someone criticizes the United States that you come to feel most American, and in my case, most Midwestern, because California, where I've lived for 50 years, has never felt as much like America as Illinois does. So I could leave it.
Okay. So how did you feel in that moment when Simone says that?
Well, at first I thought, well, that's not true. I know exactly, And then I started thinking about it. I started thinking, for one thing, that my mother had a drawer full of manuscripts and diaries, but I'd never bothered to look at them. I'd always believed, not without reason, I think, that interest in sort of family and genealogy is apt to come on with increasing age. And at the time, I guess I hadn't really reached that point, but I quickly did because I thought, I should look into those manuscripts and diaries, and so I did. And then, of course, I was hooked.
What do you and just going back to Simone, what do you think she was trying to accomplish by bringing that up?
Well, I think that it was probably the continuation of a conversation she'd been having with her American husband over the years. He probably thought that her French historical roots were, you know, kind of boring and. And she reproached him for not knowing much about his and so on. You could just hear that this was the residue of an earlier conversation.
Mm-hmm. I did have to laugh when I read the part where she said, you know, all Americans think they're descended from royalty.
Yes.
Because my first instinct was to say, well, that's ridiculous. But then I remembered that my grandfather on my dad's side had told me when I was a kid, he had done some genealogical research, and he told us that we were descended from Napoleon, which
<Yeah. laughs>
if you could see all of us, we're all like 6 feet tall and humongous, and it didn't make any sense. And so so I was a little abashed after I realized that at least in my family's case, there is always this sort of attachment to being related to somebody way back who was important.
Yes, it's true. Napoleon, actually, that's a good one, and that's one I haven't heard. Usually it's Louis XIV, as it was in my family, or the Capets. Actually, they didn't specify any particular Louis. And then I read in a few places when the book came out a few weeks ago, and I would ask the audience, for whom, how many was this true for? How many people had a tradition, not necessarily of royalty, but of someone great?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And very high proportion,
so,
almost everybody.
So I'm curious to know if any of our listeners have any royalty in their family that they'd like to share with us, or if you have questions or comments for Diane Johnson. Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. You can send us an email at will-talk@illinois.edu, or you can find us at Facebook and Twitter at Focus580 and leave a message for us there, and we'll get back to you. So just one last question about the French and their relationship to history. Do you feel that the French or Europeans in particular have a better sense of their history as nations and as individuals, or is that something that they're sort of putting forth, and we'll talk more about this question later, but just a basic answer now. Is that something that you think is actually true?
I do think it's true. I think for a number of reasons. It's emphasized in their education, but also these are smaller places. England or France, for example, has a more compact history, whereas America has a large sprawling one, and different regions are apt to insist on educating the locals with what happened in Louisiana or California, and that sort of loses sight of the big picture sometimes. Now, I've been impressed with how French school children are made to remember all those Louis, and they do, by and large.
So I'm going to shift gears a little bit. So after this encounter with Simone and in France with the generals and their wives, you decided to start pursuing your own family history and maybe starting to work on your own story and that of your family. So I'm going to shift gears into talking about Moline and your childhood there. And the first thing I wanted to say is that the winter we're currently experiencing this year in Central Illinois, and if you were recently in Chicago on your book tour, you might have had a little taste of this. It sounds exactly like your description of winter in Moline that you gave in your book. We all feel like we've been wearing our many layers of clothes for several months now.
I sort of enjoyed it. I was in Chicago one day when it was, I think, 17 below on my book tour a couple of weeks ago, and I sort of liked it. I wouldn't have liked it very much longer, but it took me back to those slow, freezing walks to Logan Grade School from my house, wearing all those mittens and balaclavas and hats and stuff.
Well, I have to say it's actually been a while since we've experienced a winter like that here ourselves. How long has it been since you've really felt the wallop of a winter season in the Midwest? When was the last time?
Well, when I left when I was 16, I moved to California, and of course I've never had anything even approaching a Midwestern winter. Even when we go skiing, which in the Alps, which are delightful, it's not that cold. It's like in the 30s. It's just just below freezing, which is nothing like below zero. In fact, I don't think French people can even imagine below zero.
No, I think in my experiences talking with people overseas, they think we're crazy for living here. So
yes.
Moline, back in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, in your book, sounds like it was largely untouched by the outside world in a lot of ways. Is that how it felt to you?
Well, it did feel that way to me, mostly because I was a bookish child and would read about faraway places. And I knew that we did not have the things that I was reading about, sailing ships above all, but oceans and pirates and castles and just all the things that you run into in the books that you read as a child. Even Tom Sawyer seemed to have a more a more adventurous life than a little girl in Moline. So even though he wasn't that far away.
Now, do you think that insularity is more of a small town thing, or is that unique to the Midwest?
Well, I think that it's just inevitably a little bit a condition of being in the Midwest. When I found myself thinking about it, I said and realized it was true that you're 1,000 miles from in the ocean when you're in Moline, or more. And for instance, during the war, yes, there were headlines. Yes, the Chicago Tribune came every morning with details of the war, but it wasn't as though you saw anything to do with the war. Mm-hmm. It just is a geographical reality, I think.
So in the book, you talk a little bit about how you loved pirate stories and you love to read. Can you talk a little bit about the library that you visited when you were growing up?
Yes, I was happy to see that it was still there in Moline when I visited it a couple of years ago. It was the Carnegie Library. Such as there were in lots and lots of small towns in America. That was such a great thing that Andrew Carnegie did, to build libraries in smaller communities over the country. And they were wonderful looking. If you've ever seen a Carnegie Library with big columns, they were library-looking libraries. The Carnegie Library in Moline, I'm sorry to say, is closed. They've built a new community library, much spiffier, of course. And I think they're looking for something to do with the building. But as of a couple of years ago, it wasn't being used as a library, which was, you know, sad. But at least they hadn't torn it down.
When you were a kid, was that, it was clearly a center for you. You went there to read and you had a relationship with the library. I feel like libraries, even now, remain at the center of small town life. Maybe, and I'm not sure that that's particular to the Midwest, but it seems like a library still remains a really important place, but it sounds like it was a really important place for Moline as well.
Oh, it was very important. And I have to say, when I was on my book tour, I read in a beautiful library in Libertyville, so that must be near you.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, it really impressed me with the vitality, the continued vitality of the library as a community center and, you know, of course, place to get books and now media-related things. And it was just very thrilling to see that community and that flourishing library.
Okay, we're going to go to the phones on line four. We have Steve from Urbana. Go ahead, Steve.
Hello. Yes. 2 points I wanted to make. My last name is Hillier. That's spelled H-I-L-L-Y-E-R. And for my whole life, my brothers and I and my father were told by my paternal grandfather that our surname was French Huguenot, and we believed him. Well, I did a little research, and it didn't take much digging. It's in fact an occupational name. The original spelling is H-I-L-L-I-E-R.
Yeah.
It literally means a workman who does the tiles for thatched roofs in huts, you know, houses. And then the other, so I just thought that was very funny because my grandfather was no dummy. He was a brilliant lawyer, brilliant attorney for the Interstate Commerce. Well, he was working on the, never mind. He was a bright man. Then the other matter I want to bring up is I had this friend. I moved to Urbana from Evanston about 2.5 years ago. And it was a very distressing time, and my close friend here, I was talking about all this stuff, family lore and photos and papers, and she's, oh, just throw it out, you know, just throw it out. That's what I did, she said. Well, if I had, first of all, I would never have done that. And then the revelations that I have had, experience going through, I knew my father was a brilliant photographer. Now I realize that he completely missed his calling. He should have been. He was a genius photographer. It's like Faulkner said. I don't know if I have this exact wording, but the famous quote of William Faulkner, where he said, "The past is never past. It isn't even dead." I've got that wrong, but the gist of it is people who think that, oh, that was in the past, forget about it, move on, they're so clueless.
I agree.
Because
and
you
it's
reveal
heartbreaking to hear.
You go back in your memory.
Say something so callous as to throw out all that stuff. Yeah, I'm so glad you didn't. Of course, going through it is another matter. And sometimes the sheer volume of things really daunts people.
Thank you, Steve, for your call. And if anyone else has something they want to ask our guest, Diane Johnson, you can give us a call at 1-800-222-9455 or send us an email at will-talk@illinois.edu or find us on Facebook or Twitter at Focus580. And Diane, we just received a tweet from Rain, who tweeted that Mary Queen of Scots is the story in her mom's family. So
in mine, too, and also... Lily Tuck, a writer whose work you might know, and we were having this conversation, and she said, Mary Queen of Scots in our family. So, of course, when you do the math, it's very likely that there are thousands and thousands and thousands of descendants of anyone that was alive at the time of Mary Queen of Scots. So, you know, all of these stories may have a sort of basis in truth, and very often they do. But also, I think there's something in the national psyche, don't you, about wanting some connection to European history or the history of the old country from which immigrants come, just to keep that connection, have a sense of the past and so on. Otherwise, a whole new country with everyone with no roots would be sort of, there'd be nothing to talk about, no stories to tell.
Right. And I think it's also because our country's history is relatively young compared to those, European countries whose histories go back millennia,
yeah,
really. And there are histories in North America that go back millennia also, but our current culture, that immigrant culture from Europe, are becoming a nation in 1776. Our history is really not that old. And so I think maybe you're right that's part of it.
Yeah, I just, it was interesting that the man, Steve, who talked about the derivations of his name, mm-hmm, which is another way of recovering history. When people think of their family names, it often suggests the place that the forebears left and fills in some of the history. In his case, a person who thatched roofs and probably came from France. So there are a lot of ways that we try to hold on, I think, to history.
Mm-hmm. We have another caller on line 4. Bill is driving on his way to his family farm. Go ahead, Bill.
Oh, hi, thank you. So I've traced my answer. I'm Midwestern. I've traced my both sides of my family back to, Minnesota and Southern Illinois, and Minnesota side back to 1600s in New England, and then the Southern Illinois side back to France and Germany, and mostly Germany. That's where Southern Illinois folks are from.
Yeah.
Everybody's got famous people as ancestors. Statistically, if you're from Western Europe, you're related to Cleopatra. You're related to Caesar. We remember the ones that are famous. And all the millions of peasants that were our ancestors and the no doubt mass murders, we sort of, those get dropped by the wayside, and we remember the famous people.
Yes, absolutely. Please don't remember the mass murderers and the misers and the people with unpleasant characters. Only the good get remembered, or the very, very bad, of course.
Right, yes. You have that sort of link to somebody who's truly an outlaw. That's not so bad either.
Okay. Yeah, in fact, somebody when we were talking at book groups said, my great-great-grandmother was the hostess for Jesse James on one of his flights from the law. So,
thanks, Bill, for your call. I'm Lisa Braltz. I'm sitting in for Jim Meadows today. We're going to take a short break here. I'm talking this hour with Diane Johnson. She's an acclaimed author whose recent memoir, Flyover Lives, contrasts her upbringing in Moline, Illinois, with that of her ancestors from the 18th century on, and it ponders questions about how Americans see themselves in relationship to history. This is Focus on WILL AM 580. This hour, I'm talking with Diane Johnson. She's written novels, screenplays, and a recent memoir called Flyover Lives. Diane, before the break, We were talking again about our relationship, true or not, to famous or infamous folks. And we took a couple calls, and we actually have another caller on line one. Cecil from St. Joseph is on the line. Go ahead, Cecil.
Hi. Thanks, Diane, for sharing your stories. Those are very nice, and I look forward to reading more.
Okay.
We have a similar kind of story in our family, and we recently found a whole lot of history, and it was related to one of those infamous people. They were a politician, and they had done some research and changed the way, after my father passed, it changed the way we all looked at ourselves. We grew up as being a heritage of Spanish men. We were very proud to know that there was a city with a very similar name in Spain to ours. And after my father passed, we came across a document that this politician from back in the 30s and 40s had an assistant chase down the family name. And it turns out that we are in no way Spanish, that we are French. We are French, indeed, again, and that that my Kemp great-grandfather actually came across on something called Ye First Ship, as the Huguenots were sent from England to the U.S., and I found that very interesting. We tried very hard not to mimic some of the things that our ancestors have done, but when you find out so much more about, you know, your real history, and it's not hearsay, I just thought I'd share that with you guys.
I think that's fascinating. A couple of things. It turns out that I had never understood the extent to which people are French in the Midwest. There was a lot of emphasis on Germans and Scandinavians. In my town, Moline, lots of people were from Scandinavia. But in fact, France owned all of America almost, from the Alleghenies to the Rockies, from the Great Lakes to the Gulf. And so there was a massive French immigration, and the Huguenots were especially a part of it. So I hope you'll be looking up more of your Huguenot, you know, ancestry. I've never heard of a case where you absolutely learn that your nationality is completely different. That's really. I wonder what they had against the Huguenots or against being French, at what point the family decided to be Spanish.
There was a whole tale that was created around it as well. My father told us that someone came from Louisiana, and we actually had a third spelling of the name that older politician used, with a W on the end for a bow at the end of our name, and they said that the people in New Orleans couldn't understand an immigration, the guy very well, so when he pronounced our name, at the end he said, Bo. Let me see, that's B-O-W.
You hear of,
Instead of B-E-A-U-X, and then eventually the W was dropped, and that's my name today.
It seemed to be like an Italian or Spanish name and end in O.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. That's interesting. That's a good story.
Cecil, thank you so much for your call. We appreciate it. And we also just received a tweet from someone named Alva who says, American history is young. Many immigrants and captives wanted to forget the past and begin anew. And we think that's an interesting point over here. I think, what do you think about that?
I do think that's true. Especially people who had undergone some kind of traumas in the old country. My family had come early enough that most of the memories of anything that happened in the old world had long since were gone. You know, there was no real recollection of the old country or anything. But for somebody whose ancestors had been chased by Cossacks or you know, let alone the Holocaust, any of those things, famines, mm-hmm. they just didn't want to talk about it, and they wanted to forget it. And so I think at a certain point, especially in the 20s, from the 1880s to the 1920s, that was very much the the program. You came, you dropped your old language. You didn't encourage your children to learn it. And you just wanted to embrace Americanness. But, of course, now it's really sad when people could have learned another language by speaking it at home and be bilingual. I mean, we can now see that this idea was mistaken in a lot of ways, that we should have kept our old languages as well as learning English, and we should have not thrown out the family papers and so on.
Right, right. I did love reading about your great-great-great grandmother, Anne. I think that's three greats.
She's great, great, great.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and so she's a little further into your history. She's, I think, born in 1779, if I'm not mistaken. So your family had come over from France and had been there for a while and had their names sort of, maybe not exactly changed, but certainly changed to something a little more American, like Francois, and your family is now Francois, and there are still people called Francois in that part of Connecticut, which I thought was pretty funny. But I really liked reading about Anne. She actually seemed like a teenage girl from any era, always feeling like she's doing all the work and no one really understands her. can you talk a little bit more about her and what her life was like before she married?
She was born, as you say, in 1779. And so that was during the American Revolution. Her father seems to have been some kind of judge. Mm-hmm. So it was, in a sense, a professional family. But, of course, things were really quite primitive in 1779. So there would have been open fires and lots of laundry to do, and they probably would have had a hired girl or even a slave, but they had to do a lot of work. And so as the oldest girl, now I've forgotten how many, there were maybe five or six daughters in the family, but she was the oldest and had to do most of that. The principal occupation or amusement for people at that period and in the area, this was in New Hampshire, I guess, was related to the church, by whatever church, to church going. You know, these were the descendants of Puritans and pilgrims, and they were very caught up in theology. And so Anne talks about going to different meetings of different denominations. Mm-hmm. At the time also that she was a teenager there was a kind of revival of religious fervor in the country. It was called the Great Awakening, and people flirted with all kinds of Methodism, Presbyterianism. Anne's family were Anglicans at that point, later would become Episcopalians. But at that time, the Church of England was still, you know, the revolution wasn't over. And anyway, so she threw herself into theological questions, like, predestination was one big subject for her, big worry for her. That the predestination is whether or not you're damned or saved has been decided, and nothing that you do can change it. And so she was worried about that, and so she doesn't talk of any kind of dancing. She does sing, but I suppose young people met each other at these church meetings, so she meets young Mr. Perkins and marries when she's 18. And then real life for her begins because they live in very rustic circumstances in the wilderness, really, in a cabin. And we get glimpses of that, too, of how really primitive life was, even for you know, relatively educated and middle class people.
Note to our listeners, if you have a question or a comment about memoir, personal history, or the Midwest place in history, yours or otherwise, we would love to hear from you at 1-800-222-9455 or at will-talk@illinois.edu. Or you can reach us via social media at Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. So the next generation after Anne, she has a daughter named Catherine Perkins, her second child. And Catherine was quite the writer. More so than Anne. Like you mentioned that Anne's writing kind of drops off because she probably had all these kids to deal with. But Catherine wrote quite a bit. Was that unusual for that time?
You know, I don't know. It's really very hard to find out how many people have grandmother diaries in their attics and things. It seems to have been relatively unusual, but they're not writing as though it were unusual. And so I think maybe girls kept diaries and things just as they do now.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly men kept diaries, especially if they had anything like, you know, statesmanlike to do or professional to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was more unusual for women's voices to be heard. And I'm just grateful that down through the generations, people have held on to these things with some sense of the importance of these women's voices. But I'm sure there must be lots of others out there. And, you know, I hope that there's somebody listening who will remember, oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to look in that drawer.
We actually recently had a program, an edition of Focus, that was about the preservation of family heirlooms, including books. So maybe there are people out there who are starting to dig around looking for those things. So that would be excellent.
It would be excellent. And then there remains the question of what to do with them.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I you know, I'm a writer, so I wrote a book. But I think we all need to be aware of what archival resources are around and which libraries would accept things like this, and we should encourage libraries to archive this kind of material, which is otherwise fragile and you know, easily lost by somebody deciding to throw it out.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We have another caller. We have Fred from Urbana on line one. Fred, you wanted to comment on place names that were adopted by our ancestors from other places?
Yes, you mentioned French ancestry. Of course, all along the rivers in the Midwest, the French were some of the first Europeans here, and they left place names all over. And from your part of the state at Moline, later immigrants from New York State via the Erie Canal and the Great Lakes, they left place names. I think maybe one of the closer ones to where you grew up was the town of Geneseo, named for the Genesee tribe, I think, of New York.
Yeah, the Indian name. Native American names were also used.
And also other town place names from New York State. Oh, well, there's a little town of Utica that comes to mind.
Yeah, that's right.
Were you aware of any of that when you were coming along there in Moline, or were you aware of the local area being called the Quad Cities?
Oh, sure, of course. It was only the Tri-Cities when I was growing up. Actually, they added the fourth one when it got big enough. I forget which one was the fourth one. Maybe East Moline or
Bettendorf, Iowa.
But it was Davenport, Rock Island, and Moline,
yep.
The Tri-Cities, for a long time.
Yep. And
place names, we were very aware of the French ones because part of our geography lesson was about Father Marquette and
yes.
And Joliet, as we pronounce it, coming down across the Erie Canal and down the Mississippi, and of course there are, you know, there's Des Moines and Des Plaines, I believe we call it, and lots of French Detroit, lots of Midwestern French names that we've anglicized. And then the rest, my mother grew up in Watsika and
Native
Chinoa,
American
names, and those, of course, are Native American tribal names. Or well, Watsika was named after Princess Watsika.
Yep.
So it's a rich tradition just in place names, and I'm glad you brought that up.
So thank you, friend.
You're welcome.
For your call. Diane, I want to get back to Catherine really quick, your ancestor. She eventually got married, and she and her husband became part of the Yankee migration, moving from what is the Northeast to Ohio and then eventually Illinois. And one thing that struck me was that sickness and death were constant, actually, in a lot of the writing that you do talking about your ancestors. Someone's always sick or dying or something terrible is happening. And there was a part in the book written by Catherine, involving the deaths in quick succession of three of her daughters. And I had to get up and pace around the room for a few minutes after reading those words. That story was incredible. How did people handle that? How did Catherine handle that? How back then, how did people even recover from something like that?
I have wondered that too. Catherine eventually had 9 children, and 8 of them died, or she outlived 8 of them. So she had to endure the death not only of those 3 little girls who were like 5, 3, and 1 or something within a couple of weeks, but over the years she'd have other children and they would die. She only had 1 boy. He died. And then all the 1 daughter outlived her. But how did they bear it? Religion, I suppose, was something of a consolation, but I'm not sure it was that much of a... I'm not sure how religious they actually were. They were church-going, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a clue in Catherine's account of the death of those little girls. When she writes about it years later, she says something like, "When I got up, they were all gone,"
mm-hmm.
meaning she was taken sick by the same illness, and she was in sort of a bad state, or
right.
was, you know. So I think maybe they collapsed. They bore it with great difficulty, and often were sick themselves. It's just a mystery, really, how brave people were.
Yes, her writing about it, I thought, was incredibly powerful. So I'm very glad that you included that in the book. We have another caller on line 2. It's Ron from Decatur, and he wants to comment on how he knows about his family history.
Good.
Yeah, a couple of comments. First off, my grandmother was a Fagot, F-A-G-O-T. She had a Bible, a French Bible, with the genealogy in it. She took in a couple of French girls who had just come over to help them out and boarded them for a week or two. They stole the Bible. So that history is gone. But my other comment is that most of us Americans are mixed. I have German, French, and English. So it's very difficult to do genealogy on just one source like the Fagots, let alone 3. So
that's
what I'm saying about our complication over here, is it makes it very difficult to do any genealogical work.
Although, you know, now increasingly there are ancestor.com sites in France, and I don't know about Germany, but I would guess probably some similar thing in Germany, so that more and more things are digitalized, it'll be possible to, you know, track people on their voyages and find out a bit more about the people that came over, you know, what the families were doing and where they were from in the old countries. I hope that's true.
Mm-hmm.
France has a lot of, the French records themselves are very good, and they go back, you know, to certainly to in some cases, the 15th century, so...
Yeah, it's certainly easier than it used to be. That's for sure.
Yeah, definitely. So don't lose hope.
Yeah.
Ron, thanks. Thank you so much for your call. And that brings me to a question about writing memoir and biography. How is that going to change now that we have the internet and access to so much more information, do you think?
Well, I think it becomes, in a way, a problem. Too much information. but in the long run, it's a great boon. All of the stuff that's been, all the census records and everything that's been digitized, and I just think it's going to be up to the tact and talent of people not to, you know, overcome to write up, to do something with their genealogical research that represents a little bit of I don't know, writerly organization and so on.
Right. Can you talk briefly about how writing a memoir, because you've worked in so many other genres, how is writing a memoir different from working in those other genres?
Well, I found that I reminded myself that these were stories, true stories in this case, but they were still stories that had to be told in a kind of not novelistic way, but bearing in mind the same things that you would bear in mind if you were writing a novel. That is, you have to make the characters clear, and the narrative sequence has to be understandable, and there has to be some kind of climax or ending to the story that you're telling, for instance, about Anne or about Catherine. So I reminded myself of those things, and then the hardest part for me was talking about my own life, because I don't think I'm a very self-reflective person, and so when I sat down to try to write about myself, of course memories came rushing in, and then I had to sort out all of this stuff in my own mind. And make a selection that would give an idea of life in Moline and what my family was like and so on, just as examples of Midwesterners, because my real interest was in this region, in the little towns and in the lives of those you know, courageous people who came trekking across the Erie Canal and then in wagons and things to get to Watsico or Bloomington or any of Chenoa, any of the little towns.
Right.
How, where they still live.
How long did it take you to research and write the book, just out of curiosity?
Well, a couple of years. I had some of the parts I had written some time before and actually published, the generals, the story about the generals and wasn't a true experience that I had written up, and so that was I had to change it and make it fit in, but it was already written in effect, and so a couple of years, because I was able to use material that I'd already put into some kind of shape.
So just to sort of wrap things up, we've got about a minute left. Do you miss living in the Midwest? I should tell our listeners that you split your time between San Francisco and France, and you left the Midwest permanently when you were 16. And I know you've been back to visit. Is it a place you miss? Is there anything about it that you miss? Or do you have more of a fondness for it now that you've written a book about your life there?
I think so. I think when I hadn't been back until a couple of years ago, about 3 years ago, and then I, of course, had this nostalgic experience of seeing where I grew up and all the things that I remembered, and that's a pleasure, of course, that we all, I hope, can experience. So what did I love? I've forgotten how green and beautiful the foliage was. How the oak trees in Moline were magnificent. Things like that. It was all much prettier than I had remembered.
We'd love to have you back for a visit sometime. You can come visit us here in Urbana-Champaign, but I actually have to wrap it up. I have so many more questions for you, but that'll have to do it for today. Diane Johnson, thank you so much for talking with me today. It's been lovely.
Thank you, Lisa. It's been fun.
I'm Lisa Braltz. I've been sitting in this hour for Jim Meadows. I've been talking with Diane Johnson about her recent memoir, Flyover Lives. You can find out more about her and her book by visiting our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. Focus is produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director, and Ryan Weber is our intern for the program. Focus is live weekday mornings at 10 with a replay at 8 p.m. You can always find free downloadable podcasts of the show at, again, our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. On tomorrow's show, we'll have an encore presentation of What Doctors Feel, How Emotions Affect the Practice of Medicine. I'm Lisa Braltz. This is Focus on WILL AM 580. Thank you so much for joining us today.